This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is with us today. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you've got questions about diet and nutrition, today's the day. Give us a call. Talk to Susan. Here are the telephone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. So if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use this number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois. She's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips, the publisher Coach's Choice. You'll find our guest, Susan Kundrat, on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Questions about diet and nutrition? Give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you on this warm day.
It is summertime, isn't
it?
Well,
it's here.
We've got a caller who's ready to talk with you already in Morris, Illinois, on line four. Hi. Let's get to this caller here. Oh. We'll try again. No. Okay. Maybe the caller will call back. I think we pushed the wrong button.
Okay, that's all right.
Okay, so that caller will give us a call back on the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We'll get right to that individual, and our apologies there for that misstep this afternoon. So how are you?
I'm good. I'm thinking about all the things we need to think about for summer nutrition now that it's warm.
Yeah, and that would be eating lots of wonderful produce that's coming to the farmer's market and coming to grocery stores.
Exactly. That's one of the nicest things about, well, what's one thing I love about living in a place with all the seasons is the changes in food that we have available. And of course, wherever you are, if you've got access to the farmer's markets, that's just such a wonderful thing to do because you know you're getting fresh food. And we do know that getting food that's recently picked, of course, nutritionally, is often better just because it doesn't have to be transported. It's fresh and often tastes better because it's so fresh. And so both from a nutrition standpoint and just to be able to enjoy the food, it's really a great time to be eating when you can get those fresh foods locally.
Yeah, well, I know that there have been greens, fresh greens, salad greens are plentiful right now. Mm-hmm. I imagine that's going to change a little bit as we're now, the temperature is being bumped up. And I imagine also that we're at the end probably of the fresh asparagus, the locally grown fresh asparagus. So, okay. Line four, Morris is back and has a question to ask. Hi, line four, Morris.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much, Celeste, for putting me on as fast as I wanted to get on.
Okay, you got it.
I'm so anxious to talk to the guest, and I am a 50-year-old woman who has never not done rigorous exercise, hiking, running, swimming, what have you, every day. And 3 weeks ago, I had bunion surgery on my left foot. And I will be off of it for probably about 3 months, which is a big shock to my system. Mm-hmm. I do not want to gain weight, even though I do watch my weight. But given my age, I wanted to know approximately how many calories I would need to reduce being sedentary now, my daily caloric intake, so that I do not gain any weight.
Well, a couple of things I would say. Probably, you know, at the low end, it depends on what your weight is to begin with, but it sounds like being fit and being, you know, in good shape and exercising, that's such a benefit to you. We know that calorie needs are, you know, really related to our body weight, but also related to our lean body mass. So the more fit you are, the more calories you're going to burn, whether or not you're exercising during the day. So that's a benefit to you. You know, when we're sedentary, women may need no more than 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 calories a day, which isn't very much. But again, the more fit you are going into that, the more calories you require, maybe more like 1,600, 1,700, 1,800, depending upon your weight. But it may not be a lot more than that.
Okay.
The other thing, you know, the other thing we really look at, and maybe you're already, it sounds like you might already be doing this, is certainly finding out what, even though you cannot be exercising like you normally would do, finding out what type of core work or strength work you can do or upper body work just to be able to maintain the lean mass you have.
Exactly. I am doing that. I'm doing, you know, 100 sit-ups, 50 men's push-ups, doing some weights, but you know, sitting down.
Yeah.
And that was my next question. Since I am relatively older, will my muscle mass start turning to fat more quickly?
Well, it doesn't turn to fat. You know, physiologically, when we think about muscle tissue is completely different from body fat tissue in the body. So what happens is if we have more calories than we need consistently, our body's going to store more body fat and we're going to have greater body fat. It may or may not have anything to do with your muscle mass.
Oh, okay.
If you maintain lean mass, if you're still doing the strength work, which it sounds like you are, which is so critical when you're not able to be doing cardiovascular work, then that helps you maintain metabolism. So, and then as long as you may say extra calories that you would have, and one easy way to do this, let's say for about an hour of hard cardiovascular exercise, we may burn 300 or 400 calories for women. And so you could say, well, if I normally exercise at least an hour every day, then what I better do is drop my calories 300 or 400 a day because I'm not getting that in. And so you could use that as a guide and then still do your strength work. Because that will be really helpful for you. And you still want to do the things you would normally do when you're eating for fitness. Eat on a schedule, make sure you're eating several times throughout the day. Particularly with the strength work, we know that it's important to get protein several times a day. So you will still say, gosh, my breakfast might not be as big, but maybe I'll at least have an egg and a slice of toast and half a grapefruit. Well, that's not many calories, but you've got protein, carbohydrates, some good fruit source and antioxidants. And so you might be considering portions. You know, for anybody who's trying to either manage their weight or maybe drop weight, we always look at saying, well, can you increase the volume of food but not the calories, which means that maybe now instead of having a small salad or a small side of broccoli, you're having a big salad or a big side of broccoli with your meal, but you're still getting maybe your chicken breast or some other protein in there. But you're trying to say, I'm still going to get full, but I need to really bump up the produce because that will help you get more food or plenty of food as you drop calories, but you'll still, you know, hopefully be able to maintain weight.
Great. Your answer was so helpful and very encouraging. Thank you so much. Enjoy it when you're on.
Good luck.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Good luck. Next, we talk with a listener in Burlington, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, would you talk to us about getting vitamin D from sun exposure? I'm very light skin. My skin is very hard to tan. I also had a brother, and actually my mother also had developed melanoma during their lives. And I'd like to know what are the best hours to get that sun exposure. It's like impossible for me to get a tan, so I don't know how much sun I should get.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that I'm the best one in terms of, you know, how much to get based on your personal body needs, but we do know, you know, you might want to check with your doc on that, but certainly as a good guide, and Celeste may have some other things she's pulling out, but as a good guide, you know, we kind of say, well, 15 or 20 minutes at least in the sun without sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily have to be in the main heat of the day, but probably, you know, maybe somewhere around, I don't know, 11 or 12, or I don't know if you've got other info there, but it certainly wants to be, you know, you want to be where you're actually getting the sun exposure for 15 or 20 minutes.
So if it's kind of a partly cloudy or cloudy, I know you can get sunburned through clouds.
Sure.
So I didn't know if you could get that adequate sun exposure and the vitamin D if it's cloudy.
Well, you still get the benefit of making vitamin D when it's cloudy if you're getting, you know, enough sun through there. If you're able to get a tan, then you're certainly getting some benefit from that. I think the biggest thing people do is they put sunscreen on the whole time, so they never get that 15 or 20 minutes without sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
But it is somewhat of an individual thing because you do have to look at your own risk.
Now, today, I believe I'm recalling this correctly, Dr. Swearingen, the family physician, was on with David Inge on Focus 580, and I think I recall him saying 15 minutes of exposure is good for the week.
Well, for the week.
Yeah.
And so you don't need to get it every day.
Right. And the other thing I want to mention is that the answer really in to these kinds of questions, coming up on Wednesday on Focus 580 in the 11 o'clock hour, David Inge's guest will be a dermatologist, an MD from Christie Clinic, Lester Farner. They'll talk about summer skin care.
Perfect.
So we'll really get the lowdown.
Great.
I know that they'll talk about that. So that's Wednesday, the 4th of June at in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus 580.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That's a great question.
That's a great question.
Great time of year to talk about this because I, too, am very fair and really mm-hmm. have to watch it. So that is the good news this Wednesday, summer skin care with Lester Farner, dermatologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. So we've got other folks coming in now. So let's just keep rolling along.
Okay.
Susan Kundrat, registered dietitian, is our guest this afternoon. She's with Nutrition on the Move, and she joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. Let's go next to a listener in Bloomington. Line two, hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I have a question following up on the lady that just talked about sun exposure. Does it make a difference how much skin you're exposing to the sun?
Well, that might be another good question
yep.
for Wednesday, but certainly it does. I mean, because if you have more skin exposure, then your body is able to get those rays and make more vitamin D. So I've seen a lot of different things in terms of recommendations, but you do want to make sure that you do have ample exposure because you've got to be able to get enough sun in there. I think the other big issue that this brings up is just the whole, concern with vitamin D in general. And we talked about this a little bit last month because it's been in the news so much. And I was speaking at a conference actually in the Quad Cities this weekend, an athletic training conference. And after I spoke, one of the athletic trainers came up to me and she said, well, I'm wondering if I'm on too much vitamin D, because we talked about this issue a little bit. My whole talk was on supplements. And she said that she had been tested because she was concerned about it. And her vitamin D was so low that they have her on mega doses of D right now to get it up to a certain level before she can go back down to 1,000 IUs. So I think the other big thing is if you're concerned and you're not sure if you're okay with your vitamin D status, to talk to your physician and ask to have that test done, because they can run that test, and many people are coming up low in vitamin D, which even then, if you're out in the sun and even if you're eating vitamin D fortified foods, it may not be enough to bring your levels, your body levels back up to normal. If vitamin D is low, we know it affects a lot of things, particularly bone health, but also maybe predisposition to certain cancers and those kinds of things.
Okay. All right, so I should become a nudist for 15 minutes. That'll work. All right.
Well, let's go on to another caller. Line three, a listener in Urbana. Good afternoon. Hi.
Well, that's good to follow. I'm calling about with a different kind of question about the differences between refined sugar and sugar in fruit. Are there any differences? Does the body process sugar from bananas differently than sugar in baked goods, for example?
Well, the difference might be with how that food is combined. In other words, let's say, for example, you eat a banana that has, particularly a banana, if it's relatively ripe, it's going to have a lot of natural sugar in it. Because you're getting fiber and because you're getting other things, particularly the fiber in that banana and starch, it may be absorbed a little more slowly, even though it's pretty much sugar.
Yeah.
Whereas if you eat a cookie or candy or something that's refined sugar in that way, the body may have more of an insulin response. Your blood sugar may go up a little bit more quickly because you don't have the fiber, you don't have other things in it. And so that might be the difference in how the body uses it,
right.
Sort
so
of how it's packaged.
More how about related to triglycerides? Because I know sugar goes to triglycerides.
Right. Well, we know from studies that even if you add more whole grain carbohydrate and fruit to your diet, and which many people do if they're trying to lower blood lipids, if they're trying to lower cholesterol, let's say.
Right.
In some cases, that will increase triglycerides, even if they would be considered what we'd say, gosh, better carbohydrates. The fact is, if you're getting more carbohydrate, eventually that's broken down to simple sugars, and that may be a factor in raising triglycerides. So if triglycerides are high, not only do we look at dropping sugar down and alcohol, but we kind of keep total carbohydrate a little lower. You know, maybe normally you eat 60% carbs, but if your triglycerides are high, often you'll be better off on a diet that's maybe 45 or 50% carbohydrate, just because your body can handle that better. And so no matter where that carbohydrate comes from. You know, a good rule of thumb with these simple sugars is that I look at them as if you're getting quick sugar, simple sugar from fruit, that's not a bad place to get it because you're also getting all these other nutrients.
Right.
Whereas if you're getting them from cookies or something like that, that might be something you have a couple of a day or, you know, one sweet a day, and that's not nutritional, and that's fine too. You just would want most of those simple sugars to come from fruits or something that's going to give you some nutritional value.
Okay, but the sugars themselves are really not different.
They're not really different in terms of once they get in the body. Your body's then going to use them. And now there is some thought that, gosh, simple sugars, if they're more of a refined sugar or corn syrup or something like that, can that do more damage to the body? Can that cause more trouble in the body?
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the case. It may be, you know, it may be more of a problem. And there's all this controversy right now, of course, on corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup. And does that make us gain weight faster? Well, I'm not sure if it's the corn syrup or if it's just too much sugar or too much, carbohydrate. But there may be something to that too. And so I would say from a fruit standpoint, you know, it's not really a problem unless someone is diabetic or they really are having to very closely watch their sugar intake. In most cases, so many of the fruits are really not that high in sugar. You know, I kind of think of them as the big three: berries, melon, and citrus. Those are three types of fruits that are very low in carbohydrate in general. You'd have to eat a lot of those to get too much sugar. And so those are three that if you're concerned, say, gosh, I kind of want to watch it, you might want to focus more on those and less on apples and bananas and things like that.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. A listener now waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could address the different nutritional breakdowns on vegetable preparation. One of my friends told me that a lot more nutrition is lost in your vegetables when you steam them in the microwave as opposed to blanching them real quick on the stove and what have you. And I went online, and there's, you know, the raw food group who says that any prep at all is really bad, and microwaves go inside the food and take out things. And I was just wondering if you had any information on that or any clarification.
That's a really good question, because there is some difference. And I think the thing is, it's really difficult to tell with the different types of produce how they react. In other words, there are some foods, for example, tomatoes. You'd look at a sliced fresh tomato and you think, gosh, that would have to have the most antioxidants. But actually, a tomato, when it's heated and cooked, such as tomato paste, is much higher in lycopene and some of these other antioxidants once it's cooked and once you eat it with a little bit of fat. So it's not really the same across the board for every vegetable, let's say. But there have been some studies here at the U of I. They did studies on broccoli and looked at broccoli, if you ate fresh broccoli versus if you had steamed broccoli, and how far along cooked it was. And as I recall, of course, the fresh broccoli seemed to be the best. And then when you cook a vegetable, you can kind of think, well, how long am I cooking it? And it kind of makes sense if you think you're steam cooking it. If you've got a steamer on a stove and you're steam cooking it maybe just a minute, and you don't really see in that water very much color from the broccoli or whatever vegetable you have go down in the water, and you eat it relatively quickly, then you're probably not going to lose very many nutrients. You may lose some compared to fresh, but it's probably not going to be very high. If you do microwave, I think in some of these studies found microwave, yeah, maybe wasn't quite as good as just a quick steam on the stove, and then fresh again being best. But I know for a lot of my clients, they can't, things like broccoli and cauliflower, they can't maybe eat them very, can't eat fresh ones. They might be gassy and give you problems. So I always say, well, maybe blanch them in water very quickly or steam them very quickly, and even then put them back in the fridge and eat them cold with dip or something. But that way it relieves some of the gas, and so it may not bother you as much. Any way you eat vegetables, they're going to be great for you. I mean, even if you have canned vegetables or frozen vegetables and they're a little more processed, they're still, from a nutritional standpoint, great. And I always tell people, eat them the way you like them, even if they're not fresh, because you're going to get a lot of nutritional value out of them, and just try to eat a little more of them.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is our guest this afternoon. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois, also a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Listeners, if you've got questions about diet, nutrition, give us a call and talk to Susan. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. One of the things that you suggested, Susan, that we talk about this afternoon, if we had a lull in phone calls, foods that fight inflammation.
Yes. There have been many books out in the last year or two on what's called the anti-inflammation diet, or again, foods that may aid the body and decrease inflammation in the body. So it's kind of an interesting area. I mean, some of it may be a little bit sort of just what's hot right now, but there is something to it, thinking about eating foods that may help repair the body. You know, one area we might think about is cardiovascular health. And when I was first working as a dietitian, I was working in a cardiovascular unit, and that was back in a hospital in Des Moines. And at that time, I always think how that makes me feel old, because I think at that time we were recommending against all eggs, because, of course, we thought at that time it was the cholesterol in a food that was a problem. No shellfish, no shrimp, no eggs. And now we know, of course, that's not necessarily we need to keep that in mind. But now, coming from that area, now we know a lot more about not only do we want to keep our cholesterol down if we can, but also, can we decrease inflammation in our arteries? Because it may be not just the cholesterol that's in the arteries that causes a problem. It might be that there are injuries within the arteries. And then that cholesterol or fat can kind of lodge in there if there's an injury inside the artery and start developing a blockage. And so we're looking at blood flow and foods that might enhance blood flow and suppleness of the arteries, as well as decreasing inflammation within the arteries for cardiovascular health. So it's really a total change in nutrition than what we first thought of with just, gosh, which foods are high in cholesterol. So not only with cardiovascular health, maybe with cancer, because we know inflammation can play a role in certain cancers and arthritis and all these things that can be related to inflammation. So there are many books out now. I think we've got a couple of them here, Anti-Inflammation Foods for Health, the Anti-Inflammation Diet and Recipe Book. And all of them actually are pretty healthy, you know, pretty good in general healthy things to eat. I'm always a little bit careful with particular foods to say, gosh, when this book says you have to eat so many, 4 avocados a day or something like that, that's pretty unreasonable. But there is something to be said for more omega-3s in the diet and more monounsaturated fat, where we'd say, yes, more nuts, more seeds, more avocados, more olive oil. Those foods might help with inflammation. And so there are several types of foods that we think if you eat more of those kinds of foods, they can be helpful.
So what are some of the powerhouse foods when it comes to anti-inflammation?
Well, besides the oils that I mentioned, kind of the oils, the fatty fish, let's say salmon, mackerel, tuna, those kinds of things. Many people don't know that walnuts are really high in omega-3s. So if you're going to eat nuts anyway and you like walnuts, that's a good thing to do. Maybe even buy a mix of nuts where you're getting some walnuts and almonds and even pistachios and some of these different nuts that probably all have a little different fatty acid profile that might be helpful. Just a handful of those. A good snack for most of us is just a handful of nuts with maybe one fresh fruit. So even to keep your calories down, maybe a tangerine or 4 or 5 strawberries and just a little handful of nuts, because then you get all this good fat, plus you get a fresh fruit like that. And just like we've talked before, if you look at foods and look at their color, we know that they typically have more antioxidants and maybe more nutrients that are beneficial for reduction of disease risk if we see more color. So then you look at blueberries and strawberries and melon and those kinds of things and how they can be helpful. So those foods, whole grains is another thing. You know, shifting, we've got a big shift now in education to more whole grain foods. You know, easy things are maybe buying whole wheat bread and having brown rice and things like that, but maybe branching out and looking, are you, you know, interested in maybe trying whole wheat couscous, which actually cooks up in 5 minutes. It's very easy, and a lot of people don't usually eat that. It might be sort of a, you know,
something new. Something to try.
Yeah, things like that. Maybe using more bulgur or more barley. Barley is a grain that's a whole grain. I have clients who tell me, gosh, I would be interested in taking it, but it's so gooey. Well, part of the reason that gooiness is the soluble fiber, which helps reduce cholesterol. So if you look at beans, for example, that's on the list of these foods.
So fiber is part of the picture.
Fiber is part of the picture, and foods that may aid with decreasing, you know, the absorption of fat in the diet and those kinds of things. It might, or the absorption of fat in terms of what your body uses for lipid production and cholesterol production. Things like flaxseed, which has become pretty popular to use. There's fiber, there's good fats in flax, and it's also wonderful.
Yeah, it's easy to incorporate in things.
Very easy to incorporate. And just choosing lower fat meats, you know, dropping down on saturated fat. Some of the books talk about eat no saturated fat or no trans fat. Pretty unreasonable to do that in today's diet. But you can certainly look at, if you're eating a fattier cut of meat, then you say, gosh, if I'm buying ground beef and it's 80%, could I buy 90%? Or could I make sure that I'm, you know, decreasing the saturated fat? And then just really looking at more produce. I'm just such a big believer in more produce and trying to say, gosh, are there ways that you can incorporate these things in your diet so that you're getting more of these natural nutrients that may help repair cells and decrease inflammation?
Okay. And this is the subject of your handout
yes.
for us this month. So listeners, if you'd like to get some of this information that Susan has just been talking about and some anti-inflammation recipes, it would kind of give you an idea of what this is all about and what kind of ingredients you might want to include to you know, boost your health and well-being, drop us a line here at WILL, the Afternoon Magazine. Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Afternoon Magazine, WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And I'll give that information again in a couple of minutes. We've got a couple of listeners, though, who are standing by to talk with Susan Kundrat this Monday afternoon. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a family member that's just been diagnosed with a hiatal hernia and some esophageal inflammation, and I just would like some recommendations regarding diet. I'm going to disconnect my cell phone and listen on the radio. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, with a hiatal hernia or esophageal problems, and hiatal hernia is sometimes when part of the esophagus is kind of, I don't know if it's say get stuck, but kind of is difficult to get food to go through the esophagus with that concern. Some of the things we look at are trying to make sure you're not eating too much at once, because that can be difficult. So spreading out food throughout the day. And again, in our culture, we tend to have these bottom-heavy diets where many people don't eat that much during the day and they eat a whole lot at night, which becomes a lot more difficult on the stomach. If you got pressure in the stomach, then sometimes that can cause pressure up the esophagus and make it difficult to digest the food and more problems with that. So making sure whatever someone's eating during the day, they're trying to really space that out maybe in 6 small meals. That's helpful. Other things with a hiatal hernia or esophageal problems is we try to avoid things that will bother it, which would be maybe spicy foods or acidic foods, things like orange juice or tomato paste or tomato sauce. Those things that might be more acidic can cause a real trouble. Things like caffeine, which can be a problem. So coffee or tea or other caffeinated foods can be problematic. Alcohol is often very problematic with hiatal hernia. So trying to avoid or really cut down on alcohol intake is very helpful too. The other thing is then making sure when someone is eating that they really don't lie down for a good hour or so, maybe more, before or within the time that they've eaten. So if you eat dinner at 6 or 7 o'clock, give yourself an hour or two or sometimes even longer before you actually go to bed or lie down, so that hopefully the food can move through and it doesn't have a chance to maybe back up and cause more trouble in the esophagus. Many people do better too if they actually have more of their liquids between meals. So if they're having small meals without a lot of liquid at one time, it doesn't expand the stomach as much, and it helps the body kind of digest that food without having to have the stomach get a lot bigger and then maybe have more of the liquids between. You still stay hydrated but not have so much in the stomach at one time. So those might be some things to look at. And definitely if someone's, you know, has a hiatal hernia, I would definitely meet with a dietitian individually and really get a plan based upon what that person likes to eat. So you can still feel like they're eating what they like for the most part, but maybe just it might be more shifting it around and how they eat it throughout the day.
Also, they might want to consider raising the head of the bed.
Exactly.
You put a block of wood.
Yeah, a block of wood, maybe, or even a 2x4 along the back of the bed.
And
yes.
So you boost the height of the head of the bed a couple of inches. That can be helpful as well.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So what do you say we talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello. I have a very quick question. Is flax seed meal, which I have been using for at least 2 years with my cereal every day, different from, would that be considered a supplement? Or when you buy flaxseed oil in a drugstore or, you know, with the vitamins and so on and so forth? Because I was told I had to quit using my flaxseed meal, and I just am much happier with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, flaxseed meal itself is a food. It's just flaxseeds that have been ground up. So that's all it is. The meal is, in my opinion, the best way to use flaxseed because since they are ground, then you get the benefit from the oils plus all the fiber. And in most cases, it's better than just having flaxseed oil, which doesn't have then the whole ground flax and all the fiber within it. So it's just a food. Now, flaxseed oil is typically sold as a supplement or with the supplements. But all that is, too, generally, is just the flax seed oil itself. So it's really not a lot different than any other oil you're going to buy. It's more expensive, that's for sure. And it's a very good source of vegetarian source of omega-3 fatty acids. But it's because flaxseed itself does have some natural estrogens, not a lot, but kind of like soy. It has some natural estrogenic properties. For some people, it may not be the best thing to use if you've had estrogen-positive cancer in the past or something like that. You may not want to use a large amount of that. So there may be individual reasons why one person or another doesn't use a lot of flaxseed, but it's just a food. That's what it is. It's just a natural food.
Okay. I hope that answers the listener's question.
This is for a procedure I'm going to have, and she just said, well, you have to quit using that. And I said, well, that is a food to me. And so I just, you know, I just wanted to be reassured by somebody that knows.
Well, you might, maybe this is only a temporary kind of a stop use. I would talk again with that.
Well,
tomorrow
I'm going to see a doctor, and I'm going to ask her to.
Yeah.
Because I really can't believe they didn't tell me to stop eating cereal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what sometimes is happening now, and it's actually a good thing. I think a lot of healthcare practitioners are becoming so much more aware of people using flaxseed oil in particular for the health benefits. And because whether it's a lot of flaxseed oil or other oils, fish oil, sometimes they may act as a blood thinner. And so often they'll say, yes, let's go off anything like that before you have any kind of procedure just for a precaution.
Right.
So you may want to tell them what I would do.
A meal. Yeah, I take 2 tablespoons a day and that's all. And I've been doing this now for years. So, that's the only question I had. And thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next we talk with a listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Okay, Atkins keto diet, correct? Atkins ki diet kar raha
hai. I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Hello, is it line 2?
You're on line 1.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm on line 2.
Oh, okay, well, wherever you are, you're talking to us. I'm sorry, what was your question? I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Yeah, my son, he's a 20 freshman at the university and so on. Earlier, he was given some medicine that he had gained a lot of weight. So in the last 4 months or so, he has, I think, kind of joined the Atkins diet, you know, just on protein and so on. And he has literally lost around 55 pounds in about 4 to 5 months. He looks much better now. He feels much better. The only other thing is that he's very stubborn about the food habits and all those things. No oil, nothing like that. And has, I think, been eating just the chicken and so on, and maybe a little bit of maybe broccoli or spinach. He's now out of the country, traveling and so on. I talk to him every day, and still I find out he's not eating much. I was wondering, you know, what can he... I'm concerned because, you know, for a 20-year-old kid, you know, should eat.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very much conscious about, you know, carbohydrates and this and oil and fat and everything. He has literally lost 55 pounds, and he says, well, I'm going to keep it. It's not coming back, you know, and so on, which is good. But he's not eating anything. What can I suggest him to eat? And he's traveling in India right now. He's mm-hmm. there. It's, again, a problem for everyone what to give him to eat because he doesn't eat anything.
Yeah.
Very, very little. Any suggestions what he can do in a situation like this?
Well, what I would suggest is, I think when someone's lost a lot of weight on a particular diet and it's really worked for them, it can be a little bit difficult to begin to add new foods. And it can sometimes be scary because you want to keep the weight loss off and you know that worked for you, yet you know that's not a balanced diet. One thing you can suggest to him is to gradually add some more carbohydrate. That's what I do with people. Maybe gradually add a fruit a day, maybe one fruit a day for a while, another fruit a day for a while, and so that he can see that he's getting a little bit more energy and still feeling fine in terms of his weight. What would be the best thing for him is when he gets back, or if he's able to do this in India, is, you know, if he'd be willing to meet with dietitians to actually kind of say, okay, you may be now at the point where we need to make a kind of transfer into a healthier eating pattern. You know, Atkins is at least in my opinion, not going to give him everything he needs nutritionally, because there's no way he's going to get enough carbohydrate and enough fruits and vegetables and everything he needs on there. But if he can find someone who can help him kind of move into a healthier diet for maintenance, now that he would be maybe at a maintenance mm-hmm. phase, he's going to need more carbohydrate now. He's going to need more energy, but he probably needs to do it in a way that he feels is controlled so that he can feel comfortable in maintaining his weight. And that would be something I'd really recommend to him, is to say, gosh, you know, maybe now you're at a point where let's figure out how you can really stay healthy, maintain this weight loss, but also now from a nutritional standpoint, not be missing out on all the other things you need. And, you know, for example, we know when people have lost weight quickly, they typically lose bone, too. They lose some bone density. And so anytime anybody's been on Atkins, and we really look closely at calcium and magnesium and some of these other nutrients as they get back to a normal diet to try to make sure that we're stabilizing bone strength, particularly at his age, because he's at a point where he can still get a little bit stronger with bone. So there are certain things like that that a dietitian could really help him with and maybe help him feel comfortable moving into a better plan for himself while still maintaining the weight loss.
Okay, let's go back and see if we've got a follow-up. Does that help?
Yeah, that's fine. I just think quickly is that it just happens to be that my daughter is with him, who is also MD-PhD, but these kids, they read at their own. He says, oh, so much conscious about carbohydrate, this and that. Mm-hmm. Won't even, you know, take 1% milk or skim milk and so on, and there it's hard to get. But practice, I'm concerned about not only bone density, but other things also, you know, because I think you gradually start losing energy and you feel a little bit weak. And being in another country, you know, at this time of the year with, you know, malaria and this mm-hmm. and that, so many other things, you might be more immune to get all these problems there.
Right. You know, one thing, this may help, we have a lot of studies on low carbohydrate intake and more problems with immunity. So we see that all the time with athletes. Once they go on a low-carbohydrate diet, they tend to have a lot more problems with illness and sickness, and they're just often not getting enough carbohydrates. But that's seen in the general population too. And so from a standpoint of, like you say, energy and just staying healthy, he's got to have ample carbohydrate for that. So what I would, you know, what I would recommend to him is say, again, maybe add a couple fruits a day and see how you feel. He's not going to gain any weight doing that. And he's going to have a little more energy. So that might be a positive short-term thing that he can do and say, gosh, I'm okay now. Maybe I could add a little bit of bread, or I could add a little something gradually. But I think the other thing, many people who go on these diets can really become so worried about it that sometimes they do need to meet with somebody professionally to say, okay, you're going to be fine, but we do need to find the transition that's going to work for you.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm looking for. How about nuts that you mentioned earlier? Like, I gave him a lot of nuts from here. If nothing, eat them.
Mm-hmm.
Almonds and all those things, I think that might be a help, I guess. Right?
Yeah, and it's going to give them some good energy. They have a little carbohydrate, not that much, but a little bit. So that's good. Yeah.
I was just wondering, is there any email by any chance if he can email you from there? You know, is that a possibility?
Yeah, he can email me actually through my website, which is just www.nutritiononthemove.net.
On the move?
Mm-hmm. Nutrition on the move altogether. .net, and he could certainly email me, and I could, you know, give him some ideas and some tips of things that he's got available there.
Thank you very much, Susan. I'll have to do that. I'll call him today. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is our guest. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. So if you'd like to talk with Susan, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It's celebrating that weight loss, which is a wonderful thing, but yet then, you know, is it sustainable?
Right.
And, you know, I can understand somebody not wanting to give up the gain, so to speak. But at the same time, you got to have to take care of
From the health standpoint.
Body, because it's a pretty complex machine.
Right. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of ways to move from a certain diet gradually into more of a, what we'd call more of our normal type of eating plan and still do it in such a way to maintain the weight loss. I think what happens with a lot of people is they've missed those foods so much that it's very easy to overeat on bread and pasta and rice and things that you're not allowed to have on that diet. And, of course, you eat a little carbohydrate and you want more and you have more energy and you feel better. And so there's ways to do it slowly, which the body can then adapt to better. But that's the way to really do it.
Okay. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, someone recently told me that because of the way milk is processed, it's actually a very poor source of calcium. So I was wondering, A, is that true? And B, if that is true, what are the best natural sources of calcium?
Well, calcium in different sources certainly been studied. There's a big group of researchers over at Purdue done a lot of study in this area where they've looked at calcium availability from milk products versus calcium fortified foods like calcium fortified orange juice and other sources. And I would have to, you know, differ with what you're saying or what you'd heard about calcium not being absorbed from animal foods or from milk, for example, because really it is pretty well absorbed. We're not ever going to absorb everything that we take in or all the calcium in a food, but it's much better absorbed, let's say, than calcium from broccoli or greens, which are good sources of calcium, but because they have phytates which bind with the calcium, we don't tend to absorb it very well. So in terms of looking at the total absorbability, yes, it's a good source. Milk products are a good source. I think the big question is many people think that they're getting probably more calcium in their diet and they're probably not absorbing all that. So maybe they do need more, whether it's from a supplement or a calcium fortified food. And a bigger concern I would have maybe are some products out there that say they've got 100% calcium. Maybe they have 100% iron and other big minerals. And so when you've got all those minerals together in a food, you're not going to absorb the calcium very well because you have too many other things. Milk doesn't necessarily have that, doesn't have a lot of iron, doesn't have a lot of other things that affect that. And then that's why vitamin D is also added, is because vitamin D aids in calcium absorption. So milk and yogurt and things like that are actually pretty good, you know, sources in terms of being well absorbed as far as calcium.
Okay.
So I wouldn't really worry about that personally because, you know, that's been looked at closely. And we know also from a standpoint of bone strength that those people with higher calcium intakes from milk products certainly have better bone density. So they're certainly getting absorbed and that's another good option for calcium.
Okay. And are there any downsides to drinking a lot of milk?
Well,
four or five glasses a day?
I wouldn't see a downside to that except that, like any food, if you're taking in a whole lot of it, you may want to start looking at, is it organic or is it a hormone-free source? That's the way I kind of judge what I eat and what my family eats. If there's something we drink a lot of milk, so we don't typically buy milk unless it's hormone-free milk or, you know, because that's something we eat a lot of or drink a lot of. So for me, that would be maybe a higher risk because it's something we consume a lot of. We eat a lot of apples. So maybe in my case, maybe would use more organic apples because that's something we're exposed to a lot. And so that might be some consideration for you to think if, gosh, if I'm eating a lot of this particular food, can I lower my risk of anything, of pesticides or of hormones in the food, because it's something you consume a lot of. And that's a good way to kind of take a look at how you might do that. So I would consider that.
Okay, that's very good. I want to thank the listener for his call, and I want to thank everyone who called this afternoon. Any last thought before we wrap up? And again, I'll give folks the address for the anti-inflammation information.
No, I guess I hope to see everybody at the local farmers markets.
Okay, very good. Lincoln Square Village, Saturday mornings, and we'll look for you.
Very good.
Susan Kundrat. She's a registered dietitian. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. She's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. And for the handouts that Susan prepared for us this afternoon, all you need to do is send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Afternoon Magazine, WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801.